right. Artificial intelligence is changing our world. Should it have an impact on monetary policy? Tell me why you wanted to write about this right now. What's happening in the world that brought this up for you?
Sure. So I guess two things. One is the effect of artificial intelligence on labor productivity. And there seems to be quite a bit of consensus. So whether AI makes existing labor more productive, so think more stuff per hour worked, or if AI eliminates labor, in terms of our measure anyway, that also means more stuff per hours worked, because in that case, there are fewer hours worked. So we're not taking a normative stance on this, saying, you know, it's good or bad. It's just that either it makes you more productive in your job or it eliminates your job. Harsh as that sounds, either way, output per hour goes up. And that piece that labor productivity will be augmented or enhanced by AI seems to be the sort of general consensus, a prevailing view. And I accept that as well. The second reason, though, for discussing this is the other, I think, growing consensus. Some of it may be motivated by certain preferences that folks have for monetary policy and so on. But nonetheless, consensus being, well, if labor is more productive, then that's a productivity shock. We think of this as sort of a productivity-induced supply shock, a good thing, more stuff, same inputs, more stuff. Then that means that this will be disinflationary. It'll ease price pressures. There's just more stuff to go around. We don't bid its price up as high and so on. And that means the Fed doesn't need to be the sort of party pooper, doesn't need to raise rates, doesn't need to keep rates high. It means the Fed can lower rates. So that's really the motivation here, is this prevailing view. I think it's safe to say that productivity is going to do the hard work, and so the Fed will not need to do that hard work. And so this means the doves are sort of right and that the Fed should lower interest rates. And in theory, I conclude precisely the opposite. And so that's the motivation.
All right. I have questions. several. First of all, do we know that AI tools are going to increase productivity? Like, does that bear out in the research, or are we just making assumptions here?
Sure. It's a stylized relationship at the moment. So, for example, there's a picture on the blog. It's just labor productivity growth. Actually, this picture predates the data that came out this morning that says much the same, that it appears that labor productivity is growing rather consistently quarter after quarter. And so, again, it's a stylized fact. Mm. It's an observation. But again, that tied together with the idea that, you know, it's either going to help you or it's going to replace you. Either way, the ratio, stuff per hour worked, is going to go up. Those two pieces of information, the empirical and then the sort of theoretical logic, is leading, I think, most folks to think we're probably more productive, again, in this very narrow sense of the measure, the ratio.
Now, I know this is getting down into the weeds, and you're the 30,000-foot guy, but you're going to feel it if your job is eliminated because of AI. Do you feel an increase in productivity, or is that only viewed from the macro level?
That's a good question. So it's a matter of production versus distribution. And I know this makes me sound like the macroeconomist that we're sort of made out to be, but the thinking is greater productivity means more stuff. That's a production outcome. Then there's, of course, the distribution challenge of who gets the stuff. And if you've lost your job and you've lost the ability to pay, then you don't get stuff, right? So that's a distribution challenge. Now, here's where I'm made out to be the monster. From a macroeconomics perspective, we reason, well, we realize the distribution challenge is very real and very difficult to address, but it's got to be easier to address that distribution challenge when there's more stuff to go around than when there's less stuff. So that's sort of where we're coming from. We think a supply shock, more stuff, has got to just make every other decision down the sort of the path, including the distribution decision, easier. So that's a 50,000 foot simplification. Mm-hmm. But again, the macro conclusion is more stuff, easier distribution problem to solve than the distribution problem that you have to solve when there's less stuff.
When does something qualify as a supply shock and not just steady growth?
Yeah, so that's a really good question. So it's a case where all else equal, and by that I'm thinking inputs, think ingredients and, you know, the known recipes are suddenly altered. Either there are suddenly more ingredients, like you found a resource you never knew you had. That's not so much the case here. Or there are new recipes, and using artificial intelligence as a way to get from my intelligence to outcomes would be a new recipe, a new way to use what we know, and so on. And so that's an example of a supply shock. We have discovered a new way to use what we have on Earth to lead to greater outcomes. And again, the consensus, I think, is that that's mostly the case right now, as we're seeing the way AI is being used in navigation or just decision-making, evaluations of circumstances. I mean, you do just get a lot done with the support of the AI.
All right. So higher labor productivity makes households richer. How? In what way?
Yeah, so the higher labor productivity, if markets, labor markets in particular, are sort of pricing labor inputs efficiently, then if you're more productive, you earn more in the labor market. So this is an argument for why the theory would suggest rates would probably be naturally higher with more productivity. And that is, if labor is more productive, their sort of lifetime earnings, if you will, are higher. And just imagine yourself knowing that not today and maybe not tomorrow, but, you know, by a week from now, you will be much, much richer. I'm just making an absurd example to make the point. Well, you probably won't wait until a week to begin living a life that aligns with a richer lifestyle.
Right.
And so you'll do that now. You'll smooth. But of course, in order to do that, you haven't gotten the big paycheck yet. You just know it's coming. And so what you do is you borrow against the future, essentially. So that places greater demand on the existing pool of savings. If households are more productive and they know that's a circumstance that's going to prevail long into the future, they begin living that life now. But they don't have that paycheck now. So they will essentially borrow against the future. And that places upward pressure on interest rates. And it's the same thing with firms. If firms recognize that capital, think machinery, equipment, and so on, is going to be far more productive with AI, well, they begin to invest in that capital now. Yeah. That, again, places upward pressure on interest rates. So the natural interest rate environment would be one that's higher, not lower, in the presence of a productivity shock. What you and I have talked about is R star, this sort of equilibrium rate when all is right with the world, would be higher if households are more productive and borrowing against the future to begin living that life now, and firms invest in machinery and equipment and data centers or in whatever, because they reason the payoff will be higher. All of this places upward, not downward pressure on sort of the status quo natural interest rate.
So why do you disagree with this overall view of people are going to want to buy stuff, they're feeling optimistic, which I'm not sure I really feel optimistic as at the macro level about AI's impact on our lives. But in the framework with which you have outlined this, that's where the pressure is coming from. They're going to borrow, drop those rates, let's go. And you're saying something opposite. Help me understand what you're saying and how it contradicts the...
Yep. So the prevailing logic is, well, if we're more productive, we have a supply shock, that's more stuff. It'll reduce price pressures because there's just so much stuff to go around. You won't get this auctioning sort of bidding war on the existing amount of stuff because there's more stuff. It just eases price pressures. And if what the Fed needs to do is to raise or keep rates high when there are price pressures, well, then if the productivity shock reduces price pressures, then they don't have the work to do. The Fed doesn't have to keep rates high. They can lower rates. So that's the prevailing kind of argument right now, that, hey, the AI is going to do the work essentially for the Fed. You'll have these supply shocks. We'll have more. Price pressures will go away. The Fed won't need to be the hawk. They can allow interest rates to go down. That's what I'm sort of arguing against, because in theory, there isn't a lot to defend that argument. In theory, it's what we were just saying. More productivity, households borrowing against the future, firms investing in machinery and equipment. These are all forces that take the interest rate up, not down. So the prevailing logic right now is, hey, Fed can ease up. There's no reason to be hawkish. They can lower rates. Productivity shocks are going to ease price pressures. Fed won't need to do it with higher rates. The theory says, actually, after the shock and so forth, as a result of the shock, rates would actually prevail at a higher level, not a lower one. So it's as they say, it's sort of the, you know, Ben Bernanke joked of years ago during the crisis that some of the things the Fed did only worked in practice. In other words, the joke was you couldn't write down a model to explain it, but it just seemed to work. Well, this prevailing argument of rates should be lower, maybe, but it only works in practice. The macroeconomic modeling would suggest we're premature in thinking the Fed can ease interest rates simply because of productivity gains.
But the last time we talked, we acknowledged the Fed is under a lot of political pressure,
right,
and is vulnerable to that pressure in certain ways. How does that show up in this conversation?
It's a really good question. I think in some ways this growing, prevailing conventional wisdom that the Fed could lower rates is itself an instrument of political pressure, saying, hey, you know, we got this supply shock. It's easier now to keep price pressures at bay. You can lower rates. And I think that's gaining steam to some extent because, one, there are folks who are arguing that precisely because they want that to be the outcome. And it seems like maybe it's a worthwhile argument because the Fed may be, well, impressionable to some extent, you know, vulnerable to arguments such as that because they don't really have the wherewithal to resist. So it's a really good question. I think in some ways it's a sort of a thought process that is in some ways motivated by an outcome that folks would like to see, which is lower interest rates.
The math doesn't necessarily
And by the way, I get that things work in practice in ways that theory doesn't predict. But my point is just we should really start with theory and then have the evidence, the preponderance of evidence, change our mind. As opposed to start with practice and say, here's a kind of a compelling story. Why don't we shape monetary policy based on it? I'd rather see the Fed sort of hold its position and say, well, here's what the macro theory says. So you're going to have to really demonstrate a preponderance of evidence that we should lower rates. We're not going to do so preemptively on this sort of seductive story of more stuff means lower price pressures, so we have less work to do.
Yeah. All right. Has the U.S. felt a technology-driven productivity boost before?
We have, and, you know, I can select the data however I want and all that. But if we look at, say, the 90s and we look at estimates of this prevailing so-called R-star, what is the rate when all's right with the world, our estimates of this R-star rose throughout the mid to late 90s as the sort of technology internet boom took off. So, again, there's a case of where productivity went up and investment in IT capital increased, and sure enough, the prevailing interest rate seemed to rise. That is what we would have predicted with a sort of standard canonical macro model.
What can go wrong?
What can go wrong is if the Fed were to stay with the theory for too long and the preponderance of evidence seemed to suggest, in fact, that maybe some loosening is necessary. And there's some theory for why the theory may not prevail. And there are sort of frictions in the economy one can dream up that maybe a productivity shock doesn't boost employment immediately. It doesn't boost output immediately. And maybe the Fed does need to lower. But again, that's an argument that I think we'd have to see evidence for. Right now, it just seems to be, as I say, a seductive story folks are telling that productivity shocks mean the Fed can ease up. And that's a little too simplistic to be the sort of North Star for monetary policy right now.
How about a bubble? Because some of this sounds to me a bit predictive. Like this is what we think. You know, we see some trends for sure. We can quantify. But the dream of AI, what if it doesn't turn out to be as lucrative as we think it's going to be?
Well, I think, you know, the problem with the bubble is you don't know it's there until it bursts. But I think you're right to ask about bubbles in the context of investment in AI, because there's there definitely seems to be, at least to me, some evidence of kind of blind faith in this technology. And I it's not to say that I doubt the technology. I'm not sure everyone who's investing in it has a business model that can sustainably generate earnings from it.
Right.
Right. So
yeah.
Everyone's got this idea. It's sort of like what the internet was, right? In the beginning, yeah. Everyone's got an idea of how to make money on the internet, and not everybody's idea panned out. So it's not so much I'm questioning AI as much as I'm questioning the business models attached to everyone's decision to invest in AI. And that has, if I'm right, that has the making of an investment bubble. So
yeah.
It doesn't mean the baby gets thrown out with the bathwater. It doesn't mean AI is a bad idea or necessarily doomed. But, I wouldn't be surprised at all if you see a froth in that market for investing in AI and it pops. That wouldn't surprise me at all. Again, I wouldn't condemn AI because of it, but it certainly could be a step backwards.
There could be winners and losers.
Oh, there will definitely be losers.
And the competition is fierce.
Yep.
One more question. We keep saying more stuff, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Like, what do you mean? Do you mean actually more goods?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, you know, AI may make root canal, I don't know, procedures easier, and you do them in 15 minutes and for an hour instead of 2 an hour. Or it makes car tire production, you know, more efficient, or it makes the automobile itself smarter and better and makes us allows us to build them more efficiently. So it could be goods, it could be services. It could be in both. AI is sort of interesting. We often think of technology as growing productivity in the goods market. We get better and better at making couches, not real good at performing Beethoven.
Mm-hmm.
But AI is sort of interesting because there, I think there's some white collar service disruptions that are likely to come as well. So it could be more productively produced goods. It could be more productively provided services. In the case of AI, it's probably both. Historically, technology tends to augment the productivity with which we produce goods more than services.
Yeah.
Again, we're not real good at haircuts 200 years later.
I still don't want it to play my Beethoven.
Right. And that's probably still a weakness. But, you know, financial services, all sorts of human-to-human services, there you might see some innovations in AI as well. So, yeah, good question. Stuff, anything in the numerator that sort of comes off the assembly line, goods or services.
Yeah. All right. Meanwhile, there's a war with Iran.
There is.
Macroeconomic questions you're asking during this time. What are we keeping our eyes open for?
Yep. Lots of potential disruption there, including, of course, in the way of, you know, petroleum. And I should just say this is, I know we're, you know, energy independent and so on, but I don't know, this is off the top here, but it's close. 50% of petroleum goes into the goods, not fuel. So it's everywhere. And so even though we are more independent than we were before, that's a very volatile space in which to, you know, execute a war. And so there's a lot more to worry about, of course. But if we're just looking at markets, petroleum remains a major input into a lot more, not just gas tanks. And so that's still a very powerful disrupting force, potentially.
Conversation for a future Monday macro. For now, we're still watching the Fed and those interest rates and the political pressure. And we'll see if you are right.
Oh, boy.
Am I going to ask you later if you got this one right?
I hope not. Only if I'm right.
Okay. Joe Santos, thank you so much.
Thank you, Lori.